Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. It's springtime, so that means we need the lamb report. Katie, what's the lamb report? I have a feeling it's not been the best.
It's actually pretty good. We have five ewes left to go. Only one of them is expected to go in the next few weeks because the rest of them are yearlings. We had a true Easter miracle yesterday where I, after obtaining some oxytocin from a neighbor because we didn't have any on hand because it's not something we normally use, and it being Sunday, had a ewe that had stalled in labor, pulled the first lamb, and I think it stopped developing a while ago. Anyway, pulled the second one, assumed that it was, you know, or gave her the oxytocin, saw a sploot of something, assumed it was just gooey dead stuff, and then it started moving. And then there was another sploot, and there was something else moving. And she has two beautiful lambs who are, knock on wood, not dead. Massively unexpected. And also, no emergency vet bill for a holiday call, which is always nice.
Bonus. Yeah.
I don't know how many lambs we have. A shit ton. I think a shit ton is probably...
That's the exact number.
Yeah. We have a set of quads. We have several sets of triplets. We have two singles and everybody else had twins. So, a shitload.
Yeah, everybody's busy. Do you have many on bottles at this point?
Four. Are you who is... I think 13 or 14 years old, putting her at roughly twice the age that ewes are supposed to stop being productive. Had a nice pair of twins, but since she's barely keeping herself alive at this point, I mean, she seems happy, but she doesn't have any extra to give lambs. And one set of orphan twins, but everybody else is chugging right along.
That's great.
Also, knock on wood, I feel weird about talking about any of this in case anything horrible happens.
Yeah, that's right. How was Easter for the humans?
Good.
She's thinking, did we even do anything for Easter?
I gave my kids way too much candy.
Good. I think that's how it's supposed to be.
Yeah, if I had realized that my sister-in-law and her girls were also getting the kids candy, I think it came from them. It might have been from the grandparents. There's no telling. It was a lot of sugar, but you know, they had fun.
Do you do indoor hunt, outdoor hunt? Do you do an egg hunt? What's the tradition for your family?
We did up in my in-law's backyard. We hid 144 eggs for three kids.
Wow.
It was pretty bonkers. I didn't really think about how much 144 divided by three was. My nieces are right on that age gap between their 12 and 14, so they're right at that age gap between when they want to participate in kids' stuff and when they don't. So it seemed kinder to assume that they might, but they didn't.
Right, yeah. It kind of depends on the day.
And we have some neighbors who are honorary family for holidays like this. So they brought their little boy who's in the same grade as the boy child, and they all had a great time just tearing around and causing trouble, which is good.
Nice. We have always done indoor hunts in my family. And how do you deal with it if it's like, I mean, your temperatures are similar to ours. If it's snowing on Easter or raining cold nastiness, do you still do an outdoor egg hunt?
I feel judged, but it's good for them, Arlene. It is. It's good for them.
I'm not judging. I'm just curious. Because I don't want to go out when it's nasty and cold and hide the things, so.
It was fairly chilly yesterday. I think if the weather had been better, the eggs might have been hidden a little more hiding-y. But the kids had fun, and it was fast. So the upside of having nieces who are older is that they think it's great fun to hide the eggs. So, you know, and I don't really know if my kids believe in the Easter Bunny or not. I'm not really sure they believe in Santa Claus, to be honest. But they're more than happy to play along if it means they get candy or presents or whatever.
Sure, you don't want to tempt it, just in case.
Yeah, yeah. There's no point pushing your luck on it, so.
Yeah, that's right. Better to believe than to be told that, oh, well, then if you don't believe, you don't get anything. That would really backfire.
So, how are you guys, Arlene?
Things are good. I've been helping, well, there's a few of us working together on a 4-H club at this point. From what I understand, from what I've heard about 4-H in the States and where I live in Ontario, 4-H is a little bit different in that ours is, each club is kind of a separate unit. So currently I'm helping to run a chicken and egg club. So it's 6 meetings and then achievement day, and then that club is completed. And then you can join other clubs with different subject matter, but each club is kind of its own thing, separate from like part of a county organization, but each club is its own separate little group. So our club last week had a night where, or the Thursday before Good Friday, which worked out pretty nice because then the kids didn't have school the next day. We had a friend of mine come and teach them how to do Ukrainian eggs. So that was pretty cool to be able to do that. She did kind of a simplified version. They were only allowed to do 3 or potentially 4 dips in dye, depending how quick they moved. But yeah, she taught them how to do all the things like the melting of the wax and then designing different patterns and all that kind of stuff, and then layering the dye in the right way so that it would reveal itself at the end. So that was pretty fun. We've got a dozen kids, which works out fairly well. It seems like the right number for a chicken and egg club. So we have one craft meeting, and then the rest of them are going to be mostly cooking. So we've had one cooking meeting so far, and then I'm trying to prep next week's cooking class as well. So we're working with egg whites. So I'm feeling a little bit more pressure on that one too. Get it right and find recipes that you can do within a 2-hour time limit is the problem too, because a lot of meringue type things take a lot longer to cook, but apparently you can make meringues in the microwave, so we're going to try that too. This is what the internet says.
Yeah, you're not going to do souffles or...
I don't think we're going any.
Really, like, push these kids?
Not too bad. We're going to try lemon meringue pie, but I'll have, like, a few kids making the crust and then a few kids making the pie, and then the two groups will have to merge together to complete it, so.
I'm thinking, doesn't Angel Food Cake take egg whites as well?
Yes, it does a lot of them. That's a good point. Then the other trick is finding things to do with all the yolks. So I found some custard and pudding recipes, so they'll be accompanying some of our other egg whitey type things.
Yeah.
And Easter happened. My oldest came home for a few days. She didn't have Easter Monday off, but she was home for 2 full days. So that was nice to have her back around. We did supper with my parents on a Good Friday, and then my husband's family got together on Saturday at lunchtime. So just being flexible about when and where things happen is always a bonus when you're a farming family. And one of the people that often does chores for us, he asked for the weekend off. So we were milking in the afternoon, so that made our time a little bit more restricted than usual, but it all worked out. So we got to do the things. My kids also got way too much candy. But like I said, we do indoor egg hunts. The Easter Bunny has always done the eggs and whatever else they get, but not too much else. They all got like a t-shirt and a swimming suit this year. So we don't really do an Easter basket or anything like that. But the eggs get hid during the night, and then you find them in the morning when you get up or whenever parents get in from milking cows. So there's that factor.
My kids did actually get baskets this year, but it was candy with like a Minecraft craft activity keychain thing and like some soap and some bath bombs. Like, it's not, I've seen, and you know, you do you, whatever works for you and your family, but I've seen some much more elaborate setups than we had.
Yes. Yeah. I know for us, it always used to be a good excuse to give them fancy Easter clothes, which they don't really appreciate that much anymore. And I mean, they might wear it if I picked it out for them, but my 18-year-old doesn't appreciate the floofy dresses that I used to always get her when she was little.
She's probably not as excited about patent leather Mary Janes anymore either, is she?
No, or little socks with lace on the tops. Yeah. I don't think I could get it. Well, I mean, I could give it to her, but she's not going to wear it. No much point.
Trying to picture your daughter wearing something like that. And my daughter would be all about it, but your daughter is perhaps outgrown that stage.
I think that that ship has sailed, yes.
Yeah.
Well, should we go ahead and introduce our guest for the week?
Yep, sounds good.
Today we are excited to be talking to Bria Ouellette, who's joining us from Maine, our first guest from Maine, so that's an exciting one for us. We have another state to cross off our map. So Bria, we start each of our interviews with the same question, and this is your way to introduce yourself to our listeners. So we always ask, what are you growing? So that can be crops and livestock and businesses and kids and all kinds of other stuff. So what are you growing?
Yeah, so that's quite the list. I actually wrote it down before I got on here because I knew I would forget stuff if I didn't. So we are a working farm, but also a homestead, so we have a lot going on. Farm-wise, we are mainly pork producers slash piglet. You know, we sell spring piglets, breeder piglets. So we have the pigs. We also have sheep, poultry, and waterfowl. So we have the chickens, ducks, turkeys, occasionally quail. We had some predator problems with the quail. I don't know if it was a rat or what, but we lost all of our quail, so we've got to restart that. This year, we are bringing in U-Pick vegetable crops, which we're excited about that. We put up a ton of hay and sell that locally in our area. We have rabbits, and other than that, the children and the business are always growing.
So as farmers, we always kind of want to know, you know, breeds and numbers and all that kind of stuff. So we'll start with some of the things that you started out with. So in terms of pigs, what are we looking at? Like approximately how many, what breeds are you raising? What kinds of things are going on there?
Yeah, so the pigs, we are primarily Idaho pasture pigs. Before that, we've done swine for about 8 years. So we've gone through a lot of different breeds. We really, really love the Idaho pasture pigs, temperament, size, all of that. So we have 4 breeding sows right now and 1 breeding boar. And I would like to double the amount of sows for next year because spring piglets are huge up here. We just, there's not enough farms that do it compared to how many homesteaders want them. So we're struggling to keep up with our list, plus selling the registered breeders. So that's what we're doing for pigs right now. And we are going to start selling cuts of pork again, which we hadn't for a while. And so that restarts in May, which means we will need to keep enough feeders growing here to send in at least 2 pigs per month throughout the year. So that's, you know, 24 to 30 feeder pigs at a time.
Yeah, so I was going to ask about some of the other animals in terms of breeds and kind of numbers that you're talking about.
Yeah, so the sheep are fairly new to us. We're like 3 years into the sheep and we really enjoy them. As far as grazing, we have a lot of pasture here on the property and they're really low maintenance. So we are bringing in a small meat flock of sheep that we're going to have a Dorset ram over. I can't remember the breed we decided to go with for our females, but they're just like a nice commercial meat mix, basically, is what they're going to be. But the ram will be a Dorset. And then we also have a small dairy flock, and we have a Gotland East Frisian ram over just East Frisian ewes.
So are you milking sheep then a couple times a day as well as part of your routine?
Yeah, we will be. We only have one ewe. We culled a lot last year because we got some ewes, but then they were older than we thought they were. They didn't do well. They didn't keep their weight on. And I would rather cull them at that time than wait for them to be sickly and, you know, half dying on me. So we're bringing in kind of all new stock this spring from a local farm near us that milks sheep commercially. And so we do have our ram already, and we have one mama that's due sometime this week, probably. She's bagged up, so
for sure. And then the fowl, what are we talking about with them?
Yeah, chickens, of course, just like anybody. I think the chickens are all over the place. We just have a bunch of nonsense going on there. Way too many roosters, hens of all breeds just running all over the place. But you know, the eggs are worth it. So, and then ducks, we have Muscovies. We just brought those in primarily because they're so sustainable. They're good mothers. they'll raise their own, you know, ducklings, and then we can just cull them for freezer or for sale. And then the turkeys, we have turkeys, and we just have some good heritage breed turkeys. So that, again, just like the ducks, they'll hatch out their own poults. They'll raise them for us. Very sustainable. We are able to free range our poultry because we have an awesome LGD on hand. She is worth her weight in gold, and we don't lose birds. So just the poultry is a big thing, because I love how you can just kind of put them on pasture and let them do their thing and kind of just feed them minimally on the grain end, and they still produce a product.
So can you describe kind of, I'm just thinking about all the different things that you're raising and the, you know, and hay and all that kind of stuff. Can you describe a little bit of what your farm looks like? Because I'm, you know, in terms of like size and structures and that kind of stuff, because it sounds like you have a lot of different things going on. So how does that work on a physical landscape perspective?
Yeah, so we are working on this. It'll be this month will be a year exactly that we've lived on this particular property. So this property that we are recently taking over, kind of working on purchasing from my grandparents, is actually 200 acres. And only like a third of it is in pasture and fields, really. A lot of it's still wooded, which we love because, you know, firewood and hunting and all of that. So, but with the hay, my grandfather has been making hay for, oh my gosh, 20 plus years. And so he just has all of these local fields that, you know, he does them. So that's kind of where the hay comes in, but plenty of pasture because they were raising beef cattle before we brought in the pigs and the sheep. So plenty of pasture, plenty of space for new infrastructure. So it's a pretty big property, especially for up here in Maine. You don't see a lot of big pieces like that available anymore.
For sure. And I don't want to get away. I'm getting away a little bit from the livestock, but how old are the kids that we're talking about today too?
They're 3 and 5.
Okay. So still little people. All right, Katie, I interrupted you before. Where's your train of thought going?
Okay. Well, Bria, I know that I saw that your Instagram handle, right, is Wicked Quail. Is that correct?
I believe so. Something like that.
I have to say that on Instagram, I've seen like quail in little bonnets, quail in little like Easter hats and shit, you know. But this is easily the first time I've pictured one dressed like the lost member of Dropkick Murphys or something. And I just really need you to please just promise us that that is actually how you would dress them up in, like, the, you know, the rolled up jeans and black shit kicker boots and, you know, white t-shirts, little flat caps, if you were gonna.
I have never tried to dress up our quail. I know the videos you're talking about, though. The guy that does a lot of those videos, he has like button quail, which are even smaller than like a regular quail. And yeah, they're adorable, but we try to breed for size here because we do have a pretty good market for quail meat. And honestly, I don't know how he gets his so friendly, because if I tried to dress mine up, like, I'd have just little peck marks all over my hands. They are the little birds that could. They have little man syndrome. They, you know, they're not scared of anything, even though they weigh like 5 ounces. So
are those button quail that he shows, are those full size? Is that actually as big as they get?
I believe so. Yeah. As far as I know, the button quail are really small. I mean, quail in general are really small.
Yeah. For the folks who haven't seen them, these birds are like the size of a week old chick, maybe. Like, they're very small. And this guy dresses them up and they like run up and down the hallway in his house and around on his bed, and they wear little funny hats. And so I'm just picturing the same concept, but with like little flat caps and white t-shirts and black boots. And it's, I would totally watch that over the little Easter bonnets, but there's that. So what generation of farmer are you? If you're saying, you know, that your grandpa's doing hay, I assume this is not a, I am just losing it today. I apologize. I am just not ready for this. It's been a very long week.
I get what you're asking.
Do my job for me, please. And just figure out what I'm trying to ask. Please and thank you. Yeah.
So I am the third generation to own the property, or working on owning the property. My great-grandfather bought the property, I believe, in the 1950s. Now, we can date the property back 204 years on paper. And so it goes way, way back. The original property was like owned by the people that like, because we're on the Bran Road, and the original people that owned the property way back when were the Bran family. So it's that old. My great-grandfather bought it. He wasn't so much a farmer. Of course, everybody back then homesteaded. They produced food. So of course he did all of that. But my great-grandfather was actually, he liked to log, which is why the property is still mostly wooded. He used to log with his draft horses, and he worked on the railroad a lot. So my grandfather, when he kind of took it over, he was more into the farming part, and they had a small-scale beef operation where they mostly just sold the feeder calves at like 6 months old, and they were Hereford Angus cattle. And we just like 2 weeks ago got rid of like the last handful of beef cows. We kept two for our own production, but I don't like super enjoy cattle. It's funny, all of my farm friends, you know, everybody owns cows, and I'm like, I hate cows. I hate them so much. They're destructive. They eat a lot. They take up so much space. So yeah, so that's where the pigs and sheep come in. But yeah, so third generation to own the property, second generation to really farm it. And I'm really trying to make it into a 100 plus K a year working farm.
So were you one of those kids who always thought you were going to be a farmer? Or is this something that has developed over time? What was your path to becoming involved in agriculture?
Yeah, no, as long as I can remember, I was like out in the pasture at like 5 years old, because we would keep two females, you know, two heifer calves every year for breeding to put back into the breeding herd and sell the rest of the feeder calves. And as long as I can remember, from the time I could walk, I was the one like, you know, out there bossing around all the adults. I want that heifer calf to stay, and I want that one to stay. And then I showed a couple of 4-H market steers as a teenager. I was in the barn every day, feeding up, washing show steers, all of that. So farming definitely has always been something that I've taken to naturally. Not everybody in the family stuck with farming. Actually, a lot of us didn't stick with farming. But yeah, so for me, it was kind of a natural thing. I kind of veered away from it. We moved away from the family and the property a little bit in my like 19, 20 years old. Me and my husband did. And we kind of got away from the cattle, but that's when we started bringing in the pigs. And the pigs just kind of stuck, because I, you know, remembered what it was like to chase beef calves for 5 miles through the woods, you know, at midnight. So
now, pigs are known to be a bit destructive too, though, aren't they? So what are some of your experiences with making that transition from one type of livestock that you know, at least kind of understood to a new one? What were some of the learning curves there?
Yeah, what I appreciate about pigs, and this definitely, pigs are definitely not for everybody. I tell everybody that comes to me looking for a mentor for learning how to breed pigs, I'm like, listen, the real deal is that at least 50% of people that jump into pig breeding are over it by the end of their first year. And I totally get that. What I prefer about pigs over cattle is that pigs are food motivated. So even if they're out doing something they're not supposed to, you know, if I've got a donut in my hands, they're going to come back. And they do like to stay together. I swear cattle just, they spread out like cats once you start trying to move them around and chase them. So yes, yeah, so that was an experience. We always had a couple of pigs growing for our freezer. So it wasn't like brand new, but it was definitely a learning curve. You know, and this wasn't like that long ago. I'm only 26. But YouTube homesteaders weren't as popular, you know, 8 years ago. So it was harder to learn these things. And you had to learn a lot of things from messing up and making mistakes. So far, the least destructive has been the sheep. And I appreciate that about them, because 8 years later, the pigs are still like making a fool of me. You know, they're like, hey, you know, that fence sucks, by the way. So,
yeah, we tried a new spot and we found a new weak point for you. So you're welcome. Yeah. So you've talked a little bit already about your own family history But what is it like in your local community when it comes to agriculture? You've talked about hunting and logging and those types of things, but are you in a community where there are a lot of other farmers, or are you one of those people that are kind of off doing your own thing?
Maine, it's a forestry state, you know, first and foremost. Anybody who's been to Maine knows that. There's trees everywhere. There's logging companies everywhere. So it's not like we don't have huge agriculture. Like you can find as soon as you start hitting like New York and further south, you start to see the bigger farms. We do have a lot of large dairy farms up here still. But other than that, Maine, fortunately, is actually huge for small local farms. Because we don't have the big commercial ones, people are used to the small local farms, and you can make decent money as long as you have a good customer base. The problem with Maine is that it's also kind of low income, unless you get, you know, southern Maine or the coastal Maine gets a little better. So you have to really try to be innovative and sustainable so that you can cut your costs down, so that you can charge accordingly to your area. But there's a huge appreciation for local farms up here, so that's not a problem. And then the other thing about Maine is that, like, that's huge for homesteading. Our homestead laws, or laws that could be like around homesteading, there's like little to none of them. So it's very easy to do whatever you want to do, especially the more north you go. So a lot of homesteading, which is where the live animal sales comes in handy, the spring piglets, the breeder pigs, and then like everybody that I know raises 1 or 2 feeder pigs for their family in their own freezer in Maine. So we kind of hit that really heavy in the spring. It pays most of our grain bill for the year. So I think if you want to be a small local farm that is very direct to consumer, Maine's a good place to be.
So what are your goals for your homestead? What's the 1 year plan and the 10 year plan and the ultimate lifelong world domination of small Maine homestead plans?
Yeah, I'm an idea girl. Like, I can't sit down and watch TV without some new idea popping in my mind, and then my husband's, you know, immediately exhausted from even thinking about a new project. But as far as homestead goes, we really need to up our food production and preservation for ourselves. The last couple of years we've been slacking on that. And then as far as farm goes, I would like to see the farm making 70K annually within the next 2 years, now that we're on this bigger property and we have space to work with. We've got all of the new business ideas rolling in this year. And and I'd like to work on making the property more sustainable. We need to bring in more infrastructure. Our 5-year goal is to have 2 or 3 of those big, like, dome barns that you see with the concrete footings. I like those for the pigs. I like those for hay storage. That's the other thing, is that we've been selling hay this long, and we don't have a whole lot of, like, we don't have any round bale storage, and round bales sell better if they're under storage. So that's another goal for us. So just a lot of things. And basically, we make, you know, 1 to 5 year goals. But really, it comes down to, I know what all of these things are going to cost. And then once we have the extra money for one of the projects coming out of the farm, we just get that project rolling.
Sure. At this point, are you and your husband both working on the farm full time? Or are there off farm jobs incorporated into the current landscape?
Yeah, so I was working the farm full time until we moved to this bigger property. And now I kind of really want the farm money to go back into the farm this year rather than paying personal bills and such. So I'm just doing like part time, 3 day a week work at other farms or seed packing companies. We have a lot of that in the area, so there's always plenty of work to do. Just to help out, my husband is a full time heating technician. Which is a very busy job in Maine. So he's got plenty of work to do. And he's also, like, I'm the marketing kind of livestock manager, customer service person, and then he's just the infrastructure guy, or if I need somebody manhandled. So he does, he spends his weekends building stuff, you know, implementing new projects, plowing fields, whatever I have on him for the list.
Sure. You mentioned earlier, and I forgot to ask, you were going to, starting this year, going into You Pick Vegetables, what are some of the things you're going to try out this summer?
We are going to start it off with peas, because we can get those into the ground as soon as the snow disappears, which will be any time, because it's, the weather here is wildly out of control. But as soon as we are above 40 degrees regularly, we'll put peas in the ground. And that will be kind of the starting one. And then this summer, we will do tomatoes, which I think will be a big hit. A lot of people are always looking for bushels of tomatoes so that they can preserve them. And we're going to do string beans, because that's the other thing that people are always looking for in bulk. And so those are the three things we're going to try this year. And I think the You Pick Vegetables are going to be one of our largest profit areas, because it's not that expensive to start seeds and get them in the ground.
Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With three levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage.
So, Bria, did you find, with the amount of homesteadery types in Maine anyway, with the pandemic, did you see a huge surge in people raising their own food and preserving, or was it already a pretty common thing?
It was already pretty common, but it got overwhelmingly common with 2020. And it was kind of funny, because like 2018, 2019, I had said a lot of like along the lines of, this seems like a silly thing to dedicate all my time to, you know, like, why am I even doing this? And then 2020 happened, and I was like, well, you know what, I guess I'm not that crazy, because here we are. And you know, it didn't even matter if you had money there, it didn't matter, there wasn't food to be bought. So local farming, though, that was so good for our local farm market up here. All of a sudden people had to look locally for their food, especially their meat. And so that was really awesome to see the community kind of rediscover, you know, buying their food down the road from a neighbor the way it used to be. And I think it's held on pretty tight up here. It hasn't gone back down a whole lot. I run a Maine Homestead and Barter Facebook page, and there are over 8,000 people on that page and over 40 posts a day of people just bartering their skills and their items, and it's super cool. So I'm really happy with the direction that our state went up here as far as homesteading and locally farming.
So I run a local buy nothing group, and I love to barter for shit. Like, it is my love language is bartering, legitimately. How do we encourage people to do that? Like, my bank is not going to accept 20 chickens for my car payment, I don't think. You know, Steve over there at the bank, if you're down with that, let me know, because I can totally hook you up. But, you know, like, I had a friend that I traded some pork to, and she brought me 5 gallons of frozen tomatoes. And cooking that down into tomato sauce this winter and being like, somebody loves me and I have fresh tomatoes, is just, I love the creativity that goes into bartering and how fun it is and how much enjoyment I get out of getting the benefit of other people's skills and other people's hard work and being able to trade something that I like doing for something I don't like doing or don't have the time to do or just don't want to do, you know? So I'm wondering how we can encourage that.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't had to really do any encouraging up here. I just was on Facebook Marketplace And we needed a pellet stove because our temperatures dropped for whatever reason this week, and our wood furnace is like out of commission. So we needed like a pellet stove immediately. And I got this random stranger down in Southern Maine to trade, beef for his pellet stove he had. And all I did was ask. Like I said, that group is super popular. I think has a lot to do with area. I think, maybe if you get into areas where people, are making more income wise, they might not be as concerned about trading and bartering. Like I said, Maine is kind of a lower income. The jobs up here pay less than the same job would in a different state in a lot of categories. So I think it's just kind of a general appreciation for the bartering. And again, the homesteading thing's already so big up here that helps a lot too. These are a lot of people that have livestock and gardens and whatnot. They have products. They have skills, they have services. So I haven't really had to encourage anybody yet. So I guess that would depend on the area. And I think 2020 kind of did it for a lot of people up here where they realized, you know, the big guys are not always going to take care of us, nor do they really want to, but we can take care of each other. And that's a big thing. And people just need to realize that and see that.
I feel like, too, maybe a lot of it's a cultural thing, whether bartering is seen as just the normal way to do things or whether it's seen as sort of what you do when you don't have the cash to pay for something, which is also fine. You know, a lot of places are pretty cash poor. But sort of normalizing it as just a normal way to do things as opposed to feeling like you're being cheap or like ripping somebody off, because too, I find I usually get a lot more value when I barter for something than if I'm giving cash for it. And it's more fun. I like seeing what people, you know, equate as the same value and things that, you know, I mean, a dozen farm fresh eggs to me doesn't have a huge amount of value just because we have them. But, you know, for someone who doesn't have birds, and especially when eggs were up to, you know, $5 a dozen in rural Iowa, really through people for a loop, you know, but getting that value, and it's more fun.
Yeah, I get super nervous when I ask people outside of the bartering page if they want to barter, because the same reason, I'm like, I'm not trying to like lowball you, you know, it's just saving cash where you can is always great, and you know, I have product that you're probably paying out the ass for at the store, so you might as well get it from me for this, you know, item you have sitting around not doing anything. And then also, like you said, culture. Maine seems to be, we have a lot of families, a lot of people, everybody that lives here has kind of just lived here for forever. So like everybody on my road, like knows who my great grandparents were. So it's that kind of thing, you know, so everybody kind of knows each other, and that makes it a lot easier too. You know, the bartering thing, I've had quite a few like elderly people, which is always fun when they try to use Facebook efficiently, but they got, you know, they get on that barter page and they're so excited and they're so pumped. They're like, this is so cool. I remember when I traded, you know, Uncle John for this and that, and we grew this. And so it's kind of cool. And I think a lot of people are excited to see it coming back, at least up here. And I encourage other states.
I think that's a good point too, because I was just going to say that that's a good point that in bartering, there is an element of trust that you have to, you know, in a place where you know people, it feels safer to barter because you know that the person that you're getting that meat from or, you know, wood or whatever, that you can trust them that they, if they said it was raised well, or if the wood was stored in a dry place or those types of things, that you know you're getting what they say, versus bartering with a complete stranger sometimes feels a bit more risky because you don't have that confidence that you know, there are so many scams out there, especially through, you know, social media and stuff. It's hard to trust that what someone is giving you is going to be the value that you hope it is, if you're not, and especially when it comes to things you're going to feed your family, it feels a bit riskier if you don't know the person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do encourage people. I had a guy from New Hampshire reach out to me because we let people in New Hampshire in on the bartering group, because you can get to New Hampshire in as little as 2 hours. So And he asked me, and he said, you know, how did you do this? And I said, I started this page and it just took off. The page is only like a year and a half old. And I said, so, you know, start one for New Hampshire. You'd be surprised, I think, if people took the initiative to start a Facebook page like that, if they wanted to see bartering happen in their area, I think they'd be surprised at how many other people are open to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You talked earlier about learning from your mistakes and, you know, trying new things. What are some areas that you feel like you're doing really well at? And what are some things that you tried and failed and maybe gave up on, or things that you persisted on and decided that you would keep doing?
Again, back to the pigs, that has just been a huge thing for us. And that comes from the other reason that we got rid of the beef cattle is because we are surrounded by small beef farms. There's like six of us all within like an hour of each other in this little tiny space. Pigs, not so much. So the pigs has been a real profit for us. And people will ask me how to go about making money off of pigs, and you have a few different options there. The spring piglets is a big thing, depending on area. I've seen some of the southern states, spring piglets only go for like $50 each, which is wild to me because I get $150 each for them up here, and I sell out. So depending on your area, spring piglets, one of the things that we tried and absolutely hated within the first year was farmers markets. It's like you go and you can either make $500 or you can lose money and sit around for 6 hours when you could have been doing something else. Farmers markets, they work great for some people, just not super great for us. And I've heard the same thing from other meat farmers. It seems to be the meat farmers in particular, they struggle. You know, not everybody wants to spend the amount of money you're asking for your local meat, or maybe they already have it at home. Whereas vegetables, you know, you're buying them fresh for that week. It's a little different. Farmers markets, we didn't love. One thing we dropped actually just a month ago is halves and wholes of pork. We have done this for the whole 8 years, and it's just not, I ran the numbers. And because of the rise in price of grain, it's just not, I'm not making enough profit off of that to make it worth my time to keep a pig on hand for 8 to 10 months, you know, because these Idaho pasture pigs take a little longer. So it just wasn't enough of a profit to bother with. And that's kind of why we're going back to the cuts of pork.
I know, Bria, as someone who did farmer's market to sell meat with two young children, it was a good way to get our name out there. It was a good way to, you know, get our product into people's hands. But I know I had one day where I paid for childcare. I paid for my spot. I drove to farmer's market at 5:30 in the morning with my kids, and I made $6. And I was just like, I sat here for 4.5 hours with my kids and the babysitter and made $6. And it just wasn't worth that, you know. And I think a lot of it too is that fresh vegetables, people can actually like pick up and smell it and see it and maybe sneak a little taste of it, where when I'm selling you a frozen raw steak, it's a little less, you know. We did pretty well with like meat sticks and things that people could eat right then and there, but raw steaks are a little harder to really push on folks. And I had another question and now it's gone. Oh, I know what it was. So has farming prepared you for parenting? Has the pivoting and the pretending you know what you're doing of farming made it easier or harder, do you think, to parent? Especially because with kids, God love them, you can't send them to the locker and start over, which some days is a real downer.
Off to the coal list.
Yes. It's the sale barn for you, kid.
Yeah, no. Honestly, and you never kind of gain control over your farm. Anyways, for anybody new to farming that's wondering, that just doesn't happen. It's always going to be some sort of chaos. It is what it is. You kind of learn to just roll with it and love it. Farmers don't farm because of money. They farm because they enjoy what they do and they love what they do. But as far as kids go, it's funny. I was actually worried. I had a ton of siblings and a ton of cousins growing up, so I had kind of already seen it all. I wasn't like worried about like the shocking part of parenting, especially with the farming. You kind of get immune to like being like, oh my gosh, did that really happen? You know, stuff happens now and you're like, well. So that wasn't the worry. The worry for me was I wasn't sure I wanted to be a mom because I am a very career-driven person. I like to work. I like to market. I like to sit at my computer and send out emails. So the family thing was really my husband. His dream was to be a family guy, a husband and a dad, and he's so good at it. I know that my patients are very, very small, and I was really worried about that, being able to balance the two and being able to enjoy being a mom. And then I found out very quickly that you kind of naturally enjoy being a mom. You know, once the baby's there, it's just a thing. You know, you like being a mom and you take to it naturally. So yeah, so the concern was definitely balancing the two or enjoying both or getting to do both as much as I wanted to. And that has kind of just sorted itself out. Farm kids are really resilient and really like common sense smart. So it's not that big of a deal.
What does childcare and work life and all the, you know, quote unquote balance look like for your family? Because it looks different for every farm family, even though often if you look online, you think everyone's just traipsing through the garden with their kids in tow or strapped to their back or something. But what does that look like for your family?
Wait, are you not Arlene?
No.
I actually wear an ankle length linen dress at all times while I mean, I've had to rent children to do that photo shoot with because my children are not amenable to it.
But just for the photo ops.
Yeah, I will say, Bria, I feel like I was a much better farmer before I started farming, and I was a much better mom, you know, better mom before I had kids, because it was so easy to be like, I'll never do X, Y, and Z. You know, my children will never see a TV screen. And now I'm like, here's the Xbox, babies. Have fun. Like,
yeah, sit down and be quiet so I can do chores. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm sorry, what was the question again? We got to chat in.
Oh, I was asking you about childcare and, you know, like how you incorporate. It sounds like you're doing a million things a day. How do you incorporate your kids or not incorporate your kids into those activities?
Yeah, so I guess exposure has just kind of made my kids really good at being involved or not involved, depending on what they want to do. It's really up to them. They can follow me around the property and do what I'm doing. They know that once I'm out there, I'm not walking them back to the house. They'll have to walk back by themselves. Mama doesn't have time to run back and forth. Or they can stay inside, and because I can see the house from all parts of the property that I work, and they can stay inside and play toys and hang out with a snack and drink. They, even at 3 and 5, you know, they just, they know things. And they can, if they need to come out and get me, I'll tell them where I'm going, and they'll just put their boots on and come out and find me. We have 3 dogs, so I'm not worried about like kidnapping or anything like that. If somebody's here, I'm going to know it. So they're just, I think the exposure, like I said, farm kids are just really resilient. They're really common sense smart, and it's just, it's easy. The more you expose your kids are so much smarter than we think they are. If we expose them to stuff, they will catch on so quickly. And then they're not that hard to have around. Now, of course, the toddler stage in the garden, like you said, everything comes off the plants, whether you want it to or not. So it's a stage, though. Everything, they grow out of it. And now, my 5-year-old is going to grow his own pumpkin patch this year and sell it to customers at my U-Pick because he wants an iPad and Mama's not buying a 5-year-old an iPad. But he can make his own money and buy it himself. And so that's what he's going to do. And because he's seen me do it for the last 5 years, he's comfortable with it and he's all for it.
Upside to people will pay way more if you have a cute kid selling it. This is my secret sales tip.
And as far as childcare goes, if I do need somebody, like, well, right now they're upstairs with their dad because he's home today. But my grandmother, because we lived with them before we moved to this property, she's kind of like their second mom. And so if I need to, I drop them at her house and they hang out with Mimi for a couple hours and everybody's cool with it. So that's a really nice resource for me to have as well.
Yes, family support is very crucial in raising farm kids. Or Katie and I are both lucky enough to live within visual distance of our in-laws and the in-law. Or
my kids are actually at my in-laws right now. There was no school today, and I said, oh, they'll go to daycare. And my mother-in-law said, oh, no, we're taking them. And I said, they can go to daycare. And she said, no, they're coming to our house. So,
great. Just don't send them back because I've got work to do.
Yeah, you have to keep them all day. So
that's right. I can see them from here. If they start coming back, that's a problem. What is your favorite thing about raising kids on the farm?
My favorite thing, I think, is knowing how much respect they're going to have for life. You know, they see life born. They see us, because we butcher a lot of our own animals for our own freezers. They see life get taken. They see sickness, and then death happens. And I think death is something that a lot of kids aren't exposed to, and they don't understand. A lot of adults avoid it too, you know? It's something that, as a society, we try to avoid. So I think that them being around all of these things and these animals and caring for these animals, they'll have a lot more respect for the lives of their fellow human beings as well.
What's one of your biggest parenting struggles these days? Doesn't have to be related to the farm, but just, you know, the general stuff that we all have a hard time with.
My 3-year-old is a whole struggle by herself. She is, she's tough. Oh my gosh. She just, it doesn't matter. You know, it's all fight with her. There's absolutely no flight. And so it's just, I'm hoping, like, I know she'll probably outgrow it and then she'll just be this strong, independent little girl. But yeah, right now it's like, holy cow. And it's like, you know, I got to remind myself, I'm like, it's not proper to square up with a 3-year-old. You gotta back down. So
yeah. One of those times where you're hoping it's going to be a skill that will serve her well later, but when she's fighting with you, it doesn't serve you.
I'll admit that I've said to my daughter more than once that, you know, when I started raising you to be a strong, independent woman, I didn't mean with me, and I didn't mean before birth. Like, those were not, maybe I should have been a little clearer about what I was aiming for. But
before we go to our county fair question, which is our usual closer, I wanted to ask you, you're doing blogging and homesteading stuff on YouTube and on the internet. What is your motivation for sharing? I mean, not that you shouldn't, but, you know, that takes time and effort on your part. So what do you gain from sharing those skills with people?
You always want to kind of try to secure, even just little points of income can help with a farm business. But I really like teaching people how to do this stuff. I really like sharing my knowledge. I really like interacting with other people in agriculture. That's where I've learned most of everything. So that's really it. I stopped doing YouTube for a little while, but like I missed the teaching part and the, you know, the interaction part of it. So we did start getting a little more heavy on that. And hopefully we'll stick through that with through the summer, because we have a lot of stuff going on here that'll be cool to show people. So mostly interacting, teaching. Homesteading and farming can get a little human lonely, because you're with animals all day or kids, And so that's just a point of interaction that I wouldn't get if I was just, you know, hanging out over here by myself like I typically am.
That's kind of one of the reasons we're in podcasting and like it so much is because we're, some days you guys might be the only people outside of my family that I'm going to see.
I also like that you just differentiated between humans and children because...
It is a difference.
I love my babies more than anything, but they're not really great conversationalists.
No, my five-year-old, knows that he's smarter than me, which on most cases he probably is. He's just one of those kids that just knows things. And the three-year-old, like I said, she just wants to fight. So, I'm either being made to feel stupid or I'm being, squared up with. So it's a little different than regular adult interaction.
Yeah, definitely. And at those ages, they're not asking you too much about how your day's going.
It is shocking once they start caring about other people's emotions and existence. You know, it still freaks me out a little when my kids do actually pretend like they've noticed that I am a human. It's a little off-putting.
What? You had a feeling?
All right. So we ask all of our guests, if you were going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be? And categories can be real or made up.
The only thing I could come up with for this was I would dominate the most lovable pigs category. That is definitely a made up one. But I'll tell you what, there's not a pig on this property, even the feeders that I'm not super hands on with, that I can't go out and move them or handle them, give them a shot, what have you. And I can do it by myself without help, which is huge with pigs. I tell people when they get into pigs, there's not a whole lot of difference between your wild boar and your domesticated pig. And they can go in that direction very quickly, and that's where people get scared of pigs. But if you handle them, they're extremely smart and they're easy to be around. So just handle your pigs. I'm with my girls all the time. And so most lovable pigs over here.
That is a very cool category. We recently had a guest from Vermont who was her local fair has a pig obstacle course. So you may have a leg up on some other people since you could bring your own pig and have your best behaved one. We'll have to connect you with that episode. Her name was Jen Colby. So their local fair has a pig obstacle course. That sounds delightful. So we'll go ahead and move into our cussing and discussing segment. As listeners know, they can submit theirs. You can send us a voice message on our SpeakPipe, or you can send us an email at barnyardlanguage@gmail.com, and we'll read it out for you or play it for you. Katie, what are you cussing and or discussing this week?
I'm going to cuss and discuss when you can think of a song that you really like, but not enough of it to hum it for Google to recognize it or anything about it to actually search.
Right. Yeah. There's not enough lyrics there to really come out in the search. Yeah.
Yeah. There's it's not even a song stuck in your head. It's the memory of hearing a song that is stuck in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I give it 2 thumbs down. Happens to me a lot.
Yeah. It's sitting back there somewhere and you want to hum it or sing it, but there's not enough to actually put it on play.
Yeah. And then you go through and you're trying to think of anything you can remember about it, and then you Google search, and then either you end up really distracted because you found something else good, or you've listened to 28 bands that all suck, and none of them were the one you were thinking of.
Yeah, they don't satisfy. And then you get another song stuck in your head that you don't even like.
Bria, I'm going to interrupt too. Is that a Basset and an Aussie sitting on the couch behind you?
It's actually a beagle. It's an 8-month-old beagle and a 7-year-old Australian Shepherd. The beagle was supposed to be a hunting dog. We hunt a lot, but that's what she does all the time. So she sleeps.
Couch dog.
Yeah. So she's great. And the Australian Shepherd. So Dinah, keeps the pigs in, and the livestock in. She's our working dog. We have a Great Pyrenees that lives outside. So all of our dogs kind of have a purpose here, which is really cool. But as you can see, they spend a lot of time on the couch, too.
It's cold out.
No one has stolen the couch out from under that beagle. So I feel like she's doing her job. She just curled right up and went back to sleep.
Yeah, she's whatever.
Bria, what would you like to cuss and discuss this week?
Oh, man, the weather. I don't know. The weather here is unreal. People will post and be like, we're moving to Maine. What's, like, what do we have to expect with the weather? And it's like, you know, just everything. Literally everything. aside from, like, we typically don't get, like, tornadoes. But everything else, we get up here. Last week, we were 50 degrees and rain. That's the other thing, is we get a lot of rain up here. Last summer, we were barely able to put up enough hay for ourselves, let alone other people. And so right now, there's a huge hay shortage because we're getting into the end of winter. Last week, we had rain all week, and it was 50 degrees. Yesterday, it snowed 6 inches and dropped down to 20 degrees with a wind chill. And next week, it's going to be rain and 40 degrees again. And that's literally what it does all year long. And then in the summer, it's really humid because of all of the rain. So it's like 90 degrees, and you're like soaking wet no matter what you do. The weather here, if there's one thing I had to complain about, it's the weather.
It was 70 here last week when we started lambing, and today we're continuing lambing, and we have 4 inches of snow on the ground, but it's melting quick, so it'll just be mud. That's, yeah, terrific.
The spring that continues.
Yay, spring. Arlene, what do you have to cuss and discuss?
I was not really sure what I was going to say today, but based on just like a thought from a few moments ago, I'm going to go with teaching kids how to have conversations with adults, because I feel like it's still a work in progress we do try to sit down and have dinner together at night, and it feels, I don't like to gender stuff, but especially with my boys, that I'm pulling teeth to get anything out of them and then prompting them to be like, now ask me. What did I do today? Would you like to ask if I did anything interesting? Like just the trying to work on getting, I mean, and then I hear them talking with their friends and it's like nonstop. And, you know, I'm not talking about probably the things that they're interested in, I suppose. Probably the same. It's a two-way street. I'm sure if I talked about topics that they were more into, maybe we'd get more conversation out of them. But yeah, just trying to teach children how to be humans. To get them to that point of humanness is sometimes a struggle. You're both nodding, so I know you know what I'm talking about.
My five-year-old is like, he's actually a super talker, and he has all the questions, and he wants to know what we're doing. He's very adult interactive, but yeah, like that three-year-old, she doesn't really much care about what we have to say. And we try to like read like the feelings book with her, and she's like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, nah, whatever. Yeah, don't really care. So we want to thank you so much, Bria, for taking the time to chat with us today. If people want to find you online, where are some of the places they should look?
Facebook is the biggest one. We interact on Facebook multiple times a day. That's where we post a lot of our stuff, a lot of our product. That's where we'll be posting our link for our meat sales, because we're going to start shipping meat all over New England in May. Which is really exciting. So Facebook is Wicked Quail and Pork Homestead. And then that's kind of the same thing. Instagram, we're not super active. I kind of just tend to forget about Instagram, like forget that it's there. And I'm like, oh crap, I should probably post something. YouTube, same name, Wicked Quail and Pork Homestead. And then our website where we have a bunch of recipes. I just posted a sourdough recipe this morning on that. And we send out weekly email updates on that as well. And that's wickedquailporkhomestead.com.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today and for taking the time to talk to us. And it was great to connect with somebody from Maine. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This is a first for me, and I was pretty excited to do something new.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Bria.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, please support us on Patreon with a donation.
Big thanks go out to our show editor, Krista Paffrath, at the Rural Podcast Network.
Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
If you want to connect with other farming families, join the private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of future guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, get in touch.